Support for this podcast and the following message come from Dignity Memorial. When your celebration of life is prepaid today, your family is protected tomorrow. Planning ahead is truly one of the best gifts you can give your family. For additional information, visit dignitymemorial.com.
If you're a business owner, you know these sounds mean sales. And from the sound of it, your business is growing. Whether you're fulfilling orders from your home office or warehouse, Stamps.com helps you stress less about mailing and shipping and spend more time doing what you love most. Listening to ASMR. I mean, growing your business. But as you grow, so does the need for efficiency. Stamps.com simplifies your shipping and mailing process. Import orders from wherever you sell online. Find the lowest rates with the fastest delivery times. Instantly deliver tracking updates to your customers. And buy shipping and mailing supplies when you run low. Save time and money on mailing and shipping. Get started at Stamps.com today with code PROGRAM for a 4-week trial, free postage, and a digital scale.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
I'm Jesse Thorne. It's Bullseye. John Turturro is an acting legend. I mean, like lots of directors have actors that they like to work with. Turturro is a favorite of both Spike Lee and the Coen brothers. Starting from Do the Right Thing, he's appeared in 9 of Spike's films, as well as 4 from the Coens. He has the distinctive look of a character actor. But unlike some character actors, he can do almost anything. He can play tough, devious, vulnerable, nebbishy, brooding, weird. He's never not himself, but no two roles are ever the same. So take his latest movie, Gloria Bell. It's directed by the Chilean filmmaker Sebastián Lelio. It's an English-language remake of Lelio's breakthrough 2013 film, Gloria. It's a movie about a relationship between two people who've both already been through a lot. Turturro plays Arnold, a retired Navy officer, divorced with 2 grown kids. He stars opposite Julianne Moore, who plays Gloria. She's also divorced and also has 2 grown kids. She's been going out dancing a lot lately. They meet at disco night at a club for the middle-aged. They start dating. Things get complicated. They've got very different family lives, different views about the world. The story gets messy and nuanced, and the performances from both Turturro and Moore keep you transfixed. This is a little bit from the film. It's towards the beginning when Gloria and Arnold go on their first date.
I can't get you out of my head. I'm constantly thinking about you. You're just so different. What happened to me with you, I thought it was never going to happen again. My head's still spinning. It was driving me crazy. I mean, I wanted to, but I was too nervous to call you. But I went for it, thank God. So, thank you. Thank you for coming.
You're very welcome.
John Turturro, welcome to Bullseye. It's great to have you on the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So I had this thought while I was watching Gloria Bell, which was, you know, you are an actor who is capable of taking over any scene that you are in, and you're also a very experienced writer and director. And this movie is very much Julianne Moore's movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if you consider that when you are preparing for a role like this, that in part your character, while you're probably the second lead of the film, is about, as they say, at least in comedy, throwing to Julianne Moore.
Well, yes. I mean, I saw the original film. And I thought, I love the original film that Sebastián Lelio
directed and wrote. And I thought the woman was great, but I also thought the man was quite interesting. When he said he was going to, you know, do it again and that Julianne wanted to do it, I read the script and I was a little bit on the fence. And then I spoke to Sebastian and he told me what he liked about the character, that, you know, it's essential that the audience believes that they have something between them. And that the guy, what he loved about the character was that he kept trying. And then Julianne asked me, you know, to do it. So sometimes you do a movie not as much for the role as who you're going to be working with. And I wanted to work with Julianne and I wanted to work with Sebastian. And it actually turned out to be quite a fun and creative environment. And I really loved working with both of them. And sometimes it's nice to be in support of something that I think is human. And it's nuanced and it's full of contradictions and stuff. And, you know, and then there are other times I want to do it, you know, it's for the part, you know, and sometimes you get to do everything.
Do you think differently when you are on set acting than when you are on set directing, or even on set directing and acting?
Well, yeah, that's a little schizophrenic because you have to be the child and the parent, so to speak. But that can be schizophrenic. But yes, yeah, I'm not in working with Sebastian. I think both Julianne and I were both, you know, we can speak up for ourselves and maybe both can be strong willed. But with him, because he's so smart and gentle, but also firm. We really tried his suggestions, and then we would, you know, vary it a lot. And he wasn't really result-oriented. He wanted to see what would happen, you know, between us. But he also had the advantage of knowing what could work from having done it before. So it'd be interesting to work with the same people in something that's brand new, too.
I'm going to play another scene from the movie, which is called Gloria Bell. And Arnold, which is my guest John Turturro's character, is like he reads some really sweet poetry about love to Gloria, Julianne Moore's character, and it kind of brings her to tears and they lean in and start to kiss and it's very beautiful. And then, as you alluded to, Arnold's outside life intrudes. His phone rings and he leaves the room to take the call, then comes back in.
Why are you here?
Because I'm with you.
Then why can't you tell them that you're with me?
Well, I don't want to involve them in our thing. No way. No way. Why drag them into a situation that they're incapable of understanding? Why? So they can say, oh my God, you have a girlfriend? You stupid old man?
I'm not old.
How could you even think of dating at your age? I know them. They'd make fun of me, and why give them the chance?
I thought that I would, you know, I'm a part of your life, aren't I?
You're the most important part of my life.
Well, then I want to feel that. And if you're lying to your daughters, then I'm not. They're grown-ups. Right?
They're not that grown up. I mean, physically, they are, but I don't know if it's a generational thing, but they see me as their father, not as a person. I've always been the one worrying about them. And they've never worried about me, not at all. It's a really lonely feeling.
Do you believe, Arnold, when you're saying those words?
Yeah, absolutely. You have to believe them. I mean, you know, people who, they always believe what they say, I think. Yeah, I think they do, you know. And that's not to say I couldn't have done it better. But yes, I don't think people think, even people, I don't think he's a liar. I just think he doesn't have the fortitude or the confidence or the courage to sever a relationship and say, listen, this is what it is. You can't call me here. You can't do this, you know, and I'm going to start doing things for myself. He's able to do a certain amount, but not he can't go the whole hog. And lots of people are stuck in dysfunctional relationships and where the person doesn't want the best for them, but they, I mean, love is such a ill-defined word. I mean, some people like to possess and control other people, and some people don't know how to get out of that. So, yes, I do think he means what he says, or he's trying to convince himself what he says. But I don't think people, even people who are really, you know, habitual liars, I think they probably can't delineate, you know, when they are and when they aren't. But I don't think that's the case. I think he's really trying, but he's... and that was kind of the challenge of it, because I'm not really... I don't really have that much in common with him that way at all. I mean, I think in that scene, he talks about it, and he feels like an outsider, and he comes from a different world.
Mm-hmm.
And that, and then seeing their family all together makes him feel even more of an outsider, because his family doesn't function. And I think if you come from that kind of family, it's hard to appreciate what other people have or don't have.
I remember one of my most vivid memories of teenagedom, or a set of memories, is going to my wife's family's house. And she and I have been together since we were teenagers. And her family, to this day, love each other very much and get along very well.
Right.
And I remember being terrified and trapped, feeling trapped by the fact that they liked each other.
That's right. No, you're hitting it right on the head. And that's what that scene is about. He's you or me, especially men, I think, can be more that way if you're coming from a different background and feeling like, well, I don't belong here, or they have this great relationship that we don't have. And I think he's very young that way, or not developed that way. You know, because later on you may find out maybe they don't like each other as much, or maybe that's a great thing and I could be part of that too, you know. But yes.
Do you have that runaway instinct that he has?
I have felt like the outsider when I was younger, that I didn't belong because I was with different cultures and maybe people were more educated than me and I was still trying to educate myself and make something of myself, you know. And then you see people that have all these chances and opportunities and travel all over the world, and you haven't traveled anywhere, you know. And now, you know, I feel I've been able to do all those things I wanted to do, you know, and I don't have that anymore. But I remember feeling some of those feelings that you mentioned.
Did you feel like an insider or an outsider when you were growing up, like as a kid?
I felt like... you know, I grew up in a black neighborhood. I moved to Italian, Irish, Jewish neighborhood, and that was much harder for me than the first neighborhood I was in. So I always felt a little bit like an outsider, yes. I didn't want to go to Catholic school because I didn't feel comfortable. I think I was right about that. Then I got bussed out to an all-black school, junior high school. In high school, it was a nice mix of people, and I felt a little bit more comfortable. But yes, I did. I felt like there was a bigger world. And I think my parents helped put that in my mind because they weren't closed-minded.
Were there places in your life as someone who grew up in a home that was sometimes violent and in a school environment that was sometimes violent?
Right.
Were there places where you had refuge?
Yes. I mean, listening to music, playing sports, dancing, you know, watching movies. I mean, I never knew anyone who had worked in the movies, but I can just tell you, you know, those were big seminal experiences, going to movies or watching, you know, Warner Brothers films on Channel 5 or Channel 9 or Million Dollar Movie that used to be, I always call it the first VCR because they'd show the same movie five nights in a row. And both my parents were movie lovers, and that was a way of emotional transportation. And I mean, I tell you, putting music on in the basement and, you know, just all these fantasies I had and stuff. And I still do that when I write a script or work on a script or work on a role, put on music and, you know, and I love movement. And Yeah. So that was really refuge. You know, we never really traveled. So I had to travel in a different way, you know. And now that I have traveled, it's so interesting because sometimes I just go, wow. I mean, I just was in Italy and doing press and stuff, but I was like in Milan and looking at the Domo in Milan. And I was like, this is unbelievable. And sometimes it hits me, you know, all the places I've gone and books I've read and things I've experienced. And I used to dream about it, you know.
We'll finish up with John Turturro after a quick break. Still to come, the Jesus. We'll talk about his iconic role in The Big Lebowski. It's Bullseye for MaximumFun.org and NPR. This message comes from NPR sponsor Rothy's. Rothy's is the everyday flat for life on the go that comes in four fashionable styles for women. The flat, the point, the loafer, and the sneaker. Fun designs and patterns while still looking polished and professional, with new colors launched every few weeks. Best of all, Rothy's are made from recycled plastic water bottles and completely machine washable, so you can feel good about wearing them. Go to Rothy's.com and enter code Bullseye to get your flats and free shipping.
I'm Bob Boylan, creator of the Tiny Desk Concert Series. We've just launched the 2019 Tiny Desk Contest. It's our search for the next great undiscovered artist. The winner gets to play a Tiny Desk concert. It'll change your life. Find out more at npr.org/tinydeskcontest.
Welcome back to Bullseye. I'm Jesse Thorne. My guest is John Turturro. You've seen him in The Big Lebowski and Do the Right Thing and Quiz Show. Alongside Julianne Moore, he stars in the new film Gloria Bell. It's in theaters now. You're one of the best parts of one of my favorite movies, Do the Right Thing, from 1989. And I think it is one of the best portrayals of a neighborhood that there is. And the feeling of what a neighborhood is and what it can mean, especially in the city.
Right.
And it's something that I relate to personally, like very deeply, even though I'm from 3,000 miles away.
Right.
From New York. And I imagine that you must have had a similar kind of understanding of the place you were from, and that might have been part of how you, you know, part of how you ended up in the movie.
Well, I ended up in the movie because Spike had seen me do this movie Five Corners, and he really, that John Patrick Shanley wrote, and I did a lot of crazy things, and it was a great part. And
I just watched a scene in which you brought a girl two penguins from the zoo and then killed them with a stick.
And I threw my mother out the window and all these things. So
that was serious.
It's like sort of a King Kong role. And so when he sent me Do the Right Thing, I'd seen She's Got to Have It, but you know, I remember the cover. It was this black leather cover. And with gold writing, and it was made in this place called Studio Duplicating, because he doesn't type, and they would type your scripts up. You would hand them in handwritten. And I thought there was something about it that related to what was going on, how I grew up. And we have very, you know, we're born like 3 weeks apart, same year. I grew up in a black neighborhood. I only had black friends, and then I moved to a white neighborhood, and I was not so welcomed at first. And he grew up in an Italian neighborhood. And so, you know, when he asked me about the movie, I said, listen, you know, we were talking about it. And I said, I'd really want to play the racist guy, because I think that's what the movie's about. Yet he's a big fan of all these black basketball players and comedians and singers. And I thought that would be the more interesting part for me. And we, with his cinematographer, Ernest Dickerson, and Wynn Thomas, the designer, and Ruth Carter, the costume designer, you know, everyone, we all worked together in the cast for weeks. And it really was I knew it was about something that was real. And I wanted to make it as complex as possible. At the same time, I had to get over my shyness at first. But once we got to know each other, I was able to share things with him, and our relationship was really like cemented, or our friendship was cemented, because I wasn't really afraid to do that in a way that I thought was fair. It's really been a very meaningful relationship in my life, and he's someone I deeply care about. And you know, I remember when the movie was about to come out, some critics saying there were going to be riots and there was going to be violence in the theaters and stuff, and they never retracted that. And I was a little worried, because I thought, well, I could be the victim of that, because I play this guy, and I've never had a negative comment from the black community. I've only had been, you know, positive reaction from it. And I was a little worried, because there was one girl on the set who had never seen a movie before, and she really believed I was the guy, and she really didn't like me. She told me in no uncertain words that she, after seeing the footage projected over and over again, that she hated me. And and I told Spike, I said, would you please talk to her and tell her that I'm, you know, playing a character? And he laughed and laughed. But that really cemented our relationship. And then I got to do the other side of that equation when I did Jungle Fever with him, which had a lot of my own personal life involved. I put in, you know, contributed, you know, into the script with him. And I've made a lot of wonderful friendships out of that. So that's a real privilege to do something like that. And I think a lot of people didn't realize the knapsack that he was carrying on his back, you know, because he likes to stir up the conversation and stuff. But he's a really good person, and I really love him.
I want to play a scene with you and Spike Lee from Do the Right Thing.
Sure.
And your character was named Pino, and he's the son of a guy who owns a pizzeria in the neighborhood. And Pino is pretty explicitly, vocally racist. And this is a mostly black neighborhood.
Yep.
And Spike Lee plays Mookie, who's the pizza delivery guy, and he is also kind of a catalyst for a lot of the story in the neighborhood. He's, you know, because of his job and also because of the fact that he's a Spike Lee character played by Spike Lee, who, you know, talks and moves and engages with everybody like Spike Lee. he's, you know, he's like the connective tissue of the neighborhood.
Yeah. He's the delivery boy.
Yeah.
So to speak.
And so in this scene, Pino, my guest John Turturro, and Mookie, who's played by Spike Lee, are talking in the restaurant together.
You know, I've been listening and reading.
You've been reading now?
I read. I've been reading about your leaders, Reverend Al, Mr. Do, Sharp Tone, Jesse. Keep hope alive.
That's up.
Keep hope alive.
Hey, that's don't talk about Jesse.
And even the other guy, what's his name? Farrakhan.
Minister Farrakhan.
All right, sorry. Minister Farrakhan. Anyway, Minister Farrakhan always talks about the so-called day when the black man will rise. We were one day, what does he say? We were one day rule the earth as we did in our glorious past.
Yeah, that's right.
What past you talking about? What did I miss?
We started civilization.
Man, keep dreaming, man. Then you woke up.
Pino, you pizza, and Frank Sinatra.
Yeah.
That's an amazing yeah that you give him.
Well, you know, I think that knowledge is the only power of resistance you have to ignorance, to absolutism, to totalitarianism, you know, fascism, whatever you want to say. Knowledge is everything. And being able to know people individually and say, okay, well, this person's all from the same group, but I like this person bores me, and this person I'm afraid of, you know. So you need experience, and you need need knowledge, you know, whether that's reading, but I think you do also need interaction, you know, with that. And I think we're seeing in the world sort of this anti-intellectual movement, you know, and you know, where people give you the answers and blame others. And it's everything becomes black and white and not gray. And I think that, you know, we're surrounded by ignorance. And, you know, once you peel away certain human layers and you scratch at the scab of humanity, you see all this, you would say, primitive, you know, and horrible behavior, which we've seen throughout history. And that's why when you read a writer, say, like Primo Levi, he talks about, you know, the truce between these wars and things that happen. And people have to be constantly civilized or tenderized in some ways. And I think, you know, storytelling can be helpful, but there's a lot of things that can be helpful. And certainly education is a big thing. And not being so, I mean, when there was forced integration, that doesn't always work. But you really need interaction with other people to get to know them. And it's essential. And I think we're seeing something in the world that is around us right now. And it certainly doesn't feel comfortable to me. But I, you know, it reminds me of like when you have a demagogue, you know, the first people that are attacked are intellectuals. You know, that's when books are burned. And so this little microcosm of a scene, you know, deals with, you know, ignorance on a very street level, you know what I mean? But that's something that really interests me, and I've tried to do different projects that deal with these themes, because I think they are the major themes, you know.
When my youngest brother, Brendan, was about 4 years old, I think, my father and stepmother had bought The Big Lebowski on VHS from, you know, when at Blockbuster you could buy it.
Right.
After
right.
it was a new release, they would, you know, buy it for $8.99. And they watched it a lot. It was in a short list of movies they watched a lot. It was like that. And I remember The Commitments and Bram Stoker's Dracula were the other ones they watched a lot of. Mm-hmm. And all great movies. And my father and stepmother taught my brother to say, "Nobody forks with the Jesus," or at least they claimed that they had taught him forks.
Right.
Because he's, you know, he went to preschool and everything. He couldn't just go around swearing at the preschool. I think my father and stepmother might have been okay with that, actually, but not at the preschool. They had some shame. When you got the part in that film, you had already worked with
them. I didn't get the part. I'd done two other movies with them, Miller's Crossing and Barton Fink. And I knew Fran McDormand from Yale Drama School. And they had seen me do a play that I played a character at the Public that inspired that character. And they said, oh, you know, they were really, Joel was very taken by it. And so they kept telling me about it. When I read it, I said, well, this, I got nothing to do. I only have a couple little scenes, you know. I didn't have to play the lead. And anyway, I was very thin because I had done the film The Truce, where I played Primo Levi. I was, you know, it was a few months after that. But I thought, you know, let me try to do something. It's a very small thing. So I came up with a few interesting physical things, because once I saw the costume and they're my friends, and I worked, you know, in big roles with them already, and so I wanted to surprise them a little bit, and you know, I didn't know the movie would become what it became, because when it came out, it came and it went, you know. And I remember seeing the first cut of my introduction. I was really embarrassed that they put all these things that I kind of did on purpose, even though they shot it to kind of make them laugh. You know, like 8-year-olds would do. Now I really appreciate the movie. And I was saying to people, I said, you know, so many people just completely missed it. You know, certainly the critics missed it, you know. You know, it's kind of like a philosophy, that film. It's a philosophical comedy.
I worked with a dude underneath the City Hall, the Civic Center Plaza in San Francisco. I worked for the Department of Elections. And he told me, I was just out of college and he was probably 29.
Right.
And we were the only guys who were allowed to talk. We would carry around these pallets of votes to be counted. And he said to me, you know, me and my girlfriend, he heard that I liked the Big Lebowski. He said, you know, me and my girlfriend, we quit going to church. I'm like, oh, okay, that's fine, you know, whatever. And he says, yeah, every Sunday morning we wake up, get high, and watch the Big Lebowski.
Well, you know, this is a strange, it's a phenomenon. You know, you talk about like all these films that make a lot of money or win all these awards, and the Big Lebowski didn't do any of that. It did very well in, I think, England, and I know it did very well in Italy, but it just goes to show you, you know, when something has resonance, you know, it was years later when I saw it with young people, and I was like, 10 years later, I was like, wow, everyone knows the lines. This is much funnier than I even thought it was. You know, I always thought Jeff was superb and just, you know, they've used elements of his own personality and he's just such a beautiful actor. It's just, and John is great in it, but, you know, Jeff captures something that I think people, you know, people don't want to grow up. You know, they, you know, there's a part of people that they really admire someone who's unambitious, you know, dresses in their bathrobe. And I don't know, but it just hit the zeitgeist. And it's very hard for comedies to sustain itself. It usually runs out of steam. And even some of their comedies they've tried hasn't been as successful as that. But something about it that is just consistently surprising. You know, and human, I think. And it, maybe because it's based on some of their friends, mm-hmm. you know, and that's the truth. But it's a philosophical outlook.
Let's hear my guest, John Turturro, as the Jesus from The Big Lebowski.
I see you roll your way to the semis. Dios mio, man. Liam and me, we're going to f*** you up.
Yeah, well... You know, that's just like your opinion, man.
Let me tell you something, Pandeo. You pull any of your crazy shit with us, you flash a piece out on the lanes, I'll take it away from you and stick it up your ass and pull the trigger till it goes click.
Jesus.
You said it, man. Nobody with the Jesus.
That's it, man. You know?
Such a great reaction take from Jeff Bridges.
Jesus, man. Well, that's just like, you know, your opinion, man. This is my younger son. He says this to me all the time. He quotes the Lebowski, you know? This really helps parroting, you know? Oh, my God.
Did you choreograph that yourself? I mean,
yeah,
like maybe
yeah, yeah.
Choreograph is too strong a word.
I'm like Jerome Robbins. I choreograph all my numbers.
You're known as the Tommy Toon of your generation.
Yeah, I mean, people, they because the reason why I don't want to have choreographers and stuff, I think that movement, first of all, I've done a lot of dancing, and but you want to have unconscious movement because it reveals. Movement reveals, and I don't want to have someone telling me how to move, you know? I mean, if there's a certain dance from the 40s, I'll learn it, but then I try to add the character stuff to it. But that's all my stuff, so, yeah.
A few years ago,
I'm sort of like Anne Margaret, you know? I mean, Anne Margaret is a big inspiration. I'm not saying this lightly. She is. And, yeah. So, yeah, think of me as the female Anne Margaret. Yeah.
Well, John, I could talk to you about your many roles for another 3 hours if we had the time, but we're out of time. So
okay.
I'm very, very grateful that you took this time to come
well,
be on Bullseye.
Well, thank you. It was a really fun and stimulating and wide-ranging conversation. So that's a pleasure to have. So thank you for having me, and I wish you well, and thanks for having me on your show.
John Turturro, everyone. Gloria Bell is in theaters now. His performance in it is brilliant, and it's a wonderful movie. John Turturro is, of course, in many brilliant and amazing movies, and he's brilliant in almost everything he acts in. I do want to say that if you go on YouTube and you search for his movie Five Corners, you will see the craziest scene possibly in cinema history that is performed credibly by credible professionals. It is so bonkers. It's a little distressing, too. If you really don't want to see, spoiler alert, any birds get hurt, then don't watch it. But man, I will remember it forever, having seen it once. We've come to the end of another episode of Bullseye. Bullseye is recorded at MaximumFun.org World Headquarters, overlooking MacArthur Park in beautiful Los Angeles, California, where we had swarms of painted lady butterflies outside of our window this week. It was a really remarkable sight. The show is produced by Speaking Into Microphones. Our producer is Kevin Ferguson. Jesus Ambrosio is our associate producer. We have help from Casey O'Brien. Our new production fellow is Jordan Cowling. Thank you, Jordan. Our interstitial music is by DJ W, a.k.a. Dan Wally. Our thanks to him for making that music for us. Our theme song is called Huddle Formation. It's by the band The Go Team. They and their label Memphis Industries were nice enough to let us use that. Our thanks to them, of course. You should go support that great band. And before you go, I have been making this show for nigh on 2 decades. Coming up on 2 decades, and almost every episode we've ever made is on our website at MaximumFun.org. You can also find us on YouTube, where these interviews that you heard today and almost all of our interviews for the past few years are up and easily shareable and searchable. Just search for Bullseye with Jesse Thorne on YouTube. We're also on Facebook and Twitter at Bullseye and Facebook.com/Bullseye with Jesse Thorne. I guess that's about it. Just remember, all great radio hosts have a signature sign-off.
Bullseye with Jesse Thorne is a production of MaximumFun.org and is distributed by NPR.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Shopify, the global commerce platform that helps you sell and show up exactly the way you want to. Customize your online store to your style. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/NPR. This message comes from NPR sponsor Capital One. With the Spark Cash Plus card, you earn unlimited 2% cash back on every purchase for your business. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/SparkCashPlus. Terms and conditions apply.
On this week's episode of Wildcard, actor Chris Pine tells us it's okay not to be perfect.
My film got absolutely decimated when it premiered, which brings up for me one of my primary triggers or whatever is like not being liked.
I'm Rachel Martin. Chris Pine on how to find joy in imperfection. That's on NPR's new podcast, Wildcard, the game where cards control the conversation.